Chapter 29 War Clouds. To coincide with God's government is the proper incentive to the action of all nations. Mary Baker Eddy, 1898. On the 15th of February, when Mrs. Knapp was struggling with mental malpractice, malicious mind brought about an occurrence of international import, the sinking of the American battleship, Maine, at Havana Harbor in Cuba, that island country where insurrectionists had been fighting against Spanish rule for many, many months. Just after Mrs. Knapp's death, the Boston Herald asked Mrs. Eddy to express her views upon the question, quote, "Should difficulties between the United States and Spain be settled peacefully by statesmanship and diplomacy in a way honorable and satisfactory to both nations?" End quote. Her response of March 19th, Miscellany, page 277, was published in the Sunday Herald on March 20th and said essentially that there was no other way to settle difficulties between individuals or nations, that, quote, "a bullet in a man's heart never settled the question of his life," end quote. 10 days later, on the 30th of March, the leader wrote to Mrs. William P. McKinley, wife of the President of the United States, "In this hour of our nation's suspense, let me rejoice with thee that its revered chief magistrate is in every respect equal to the hour, and fervently hope that Congress be found equal to coinciding with his wisdom. The present prosperity of our country, when compared with its condition under a previous administration, seems almost anomalous. No greater glory could crown any nation than to rebuke and pardon so foul a crime as the destruction of the Maine and the loss of her brave men. And this, while the nation was feeding the starving foemen. The question is grave. Does God require the best government on earth to disturb its peace by war, to give Cuba her independence, when other nations offer no help? Foreign nations are allied, but the United States stands alone in her glory. This suggests to me the situation in our country of the rising sect of Christian Scientists. While Catholic and Protestant churches are leagued together, our churches stand alone among religious sects and have yet to gain their independence, the rights of conscience, according to the laws of our Constitution. It is a strange thing to say that under a free government, a bill is brought against them for healing the sick, and again, that they are prosecuted for not healing the sick. Although our courts find no fault with the MD who loses his patients or claims to help them. Pardon my straying into this illusion, but my purpose is to say, notwithstanding this, I admonish Christian Scientists never to take the sword, but always endeavor to overcome evil with good. And obeying this rule, the prosperity of Christian Science is unexceptional, for the principle which governs it is mighty in demolishing wrong and sustaining right. This little leaven of rightness will finally leaven the whole lump of nations, till navies and armies are not requisite, and the brotherhood of man is established on the principle of one God, or Father, and loving our neighbor as ourself. Accept my heartfelt hope that you are in health and the enjoyment of a peace that the world cannot disturb. A jingoistic press brought popular feeling in America to a war pitch causing President McKinley on April 11th to ask Congress for authority to end the civil war in Cuba. Once again, Mrs. Eddy's opinion on the subject was published in the Boston Herald of April 17th, but her first two paragraphs were deleted from the reprint in Proseworks, Miscellany, page 278. Special Dispatch to the Sunday Herald, Concord, New Hampshire, April 16th, 1898. To answer many communications, Mrs. Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, has issued the following. In order to close the multitudinous questions addressed to me on the subject of the war cloud and the sober second thought of our Chief Magistrate, President McKinley, I will say, in my poor opinion, it had been better that our friendly nation in the first instance had wiped her hands of Cuba altogether. As the situation now is, or seems to be, to acknowledge the independence of Cuba might severely serve to teach this weak, wicked neighbor self-government. In this case, it would rid both Spain and the United States of an incubus and reward our nation's generosity and magnanimity. While our nation was on the verge of war, Judge Hannah was contending with war clouds of another nature. Those surrounding Hannah he saw as lack of time and overwork. Finally, in his distress, he wrote to Mrs. Eddy, asking permission to resign some of his positions. In response, the leader asked him instead to adopt her method of relief, saying that had she not adopted such a course, she never could have accomplished her work. That method was to take certain hours each day for self-work, during which time he was not to be interrupted by anyone for any purpose. Every claim must be reduced to its common denominator, animal magnetism, in order to refute it effectively. But in this case, the judge sought a respite in a temporary escape from the pressure. He and another Boston official, William P. McKenzie, quietly slipped away for a vacation, keeping their destination a secret. The day they left, Mrs. Hannah was distressed to receive an urgent message from Mrs. Eddy to have the two men come to her at once. Turning to mind for guidance, Mrs. Hannah located the hackman who had called for the men that morning, and through him was able to trace where they were. Mrs. Eddy's letter to Hannah and McKenzie on this occasion stated, "Return at once to Boston and find your retreat for an outing within a short distance of human help. if indeed there is the least occasion for it. Had I known sooner the place where you were sent by malicious animal magnetism, I would sooner have delivered my message to you, no doubt. You can take my method, bar your doors, and then hold your solitude with moral dignity by meeting the merciless selfishness of callers with a fixed rule and the divine imperative principle to be alone with God and never break this rule till you have your interval of study and prayer. I am an exception to all peace on earth, but not to goodwill. The male and the male and female claim undisputed powers to break my peace and rob me of all individual exemption from labor. But you have no need of thus surrendering your rights for others. I have written this in bed in the still hours while others sleep, about 3 o'clock in the morning. Somewhat chagrined when he compared his burden of overwork with that of the leader, Hannah did adopt her method for relief. He betook himself to the tower room of Mrs. Eddy's Commonwealth Avenue house, where the Hannahs resided, for a daily respite from the world. And in this upper chamber, he did find the relief he needed in daily communion with God. He also found much more. In studying Isaiah, he began to see that the 54th chapter prophesied of Mary Baker Eddy's work, as surely as the 53rd chapter foretold Jesus' mission. A letter he had received from Mrs. Eddy the previous May confirmed and strengthened his growing conviction. 21 years ago, when the first revolt took place in our church, I had a vision and uttered it. We then had no funds, I no salary, and Christian Science few followers. In this vision, I prophesied great prosperity, plenty of money, blessings numberless, and the utterance was to the daughter of Zion. Quote, she shall sit under her own vine and fig tree, and all peoples shall hear her gladly. End quote. That was when I had but one or two loyal students. All had deserted in the darkest hour. The people scorned it, even those I raised instantly from the dream of death would shun me in the street. In 1898, that dear verse in my hall here, Daughter of Zion, awake from thy sadness, etc., was suggested to my thought that for 50 years had been forgotten. Oh, the goodness and loving kindness of our God! Who can tell it? Oh, the long and still continued nail and spear, and, quote, my God, hast thou forsaken me? End quote. Oh, the love that never faileth. Shortly before this, a student had sent Editor Hannah a little book published in 1838, entitled Fragments from the Study of a Pastor, together with the following story. I would like to tell you how the book came into my hands. It is interesting to know how it came to light. 2 years ago, last winter, I was living in a furnished house, which I rented of a dear friend. There was in the house a large number of books, which once belonged to an old uncle. I used to sit by a window when reading. Close to this window stood a small bookcase, filled mostly with small old books. Two or three times, perhaps oftener, when sitting there, the thought came, I wonder if there is not something among those books that would give light on the Bible, or explain its truth, and would say, sometime I will look the books over. One morning, I was sorely tempted. After the morning's work was finished, I sat down with Science and Help to dispel the seeming error. I had read but a short time when the thought again came that there might be something in the bookcase of value. I looked at the books, took one out. The first or second, I cannot remember which, was The Church in the Wilderness. I commenced reading in the middle of the chapter, but the little I read healed me. The next day, as soon as I returned from church, I read the whole chapter. I then invited the students up to read it. When I read it a year from that time, I saw far more than at first. Thus was brought to light the wonderful vision of Reverend Gardner Spring, pastor of the Brick Presbyterian Church of New York. He had seen in his vision the trials and triumphs of the woman of Bible prophecy, and titled that chapter of his Fragments, The Church in the Wilderness. As Hannah began perusing Reverend Spring's vision, along with his study of Isaiah 54, he felt that both were prophecies of Mrs. Eddy and her mission. That mission was keeping the leader busy night and day in the spring of 1898. The ban against teaching when Miscellaneous Writings was published had expired, and a notice in the March Journal stated, I hereby notify the field that on March 1st, the year expires in which Christian Scientists were requested to abstain from teaching. Today, my message to you is that loyal students from the Massachusetts Metaphysical College who have proven themselves good and useful teachers may instruct two classes of not over 30 students during this ensuing year. May our God that is love teach us this year and every year how to serve Him. May the dear, faithful laborers who are not required to teach this year, quote, wait patiently on the Lord, and He will renew their strength, end quote, for that which is to come. Mary Baker G. Eddy. The most outstanding class taught by any student in the spring or summer of 1898 was the one taught by Ezra Buswell. Though the teachers were very busy, the field needed prodding regarding the new board of lectureship, and a notice in the March Journal reminded them that the branch churches, quote, may apply to any member of this board of lectureship for aid, and it shall be granted them, end quote. Evidently, the Bible Lesson Committee needed prodding, too, for the new lesson topics did not appear in the April Quarterly. On the 15th of April, a message to William Mackenzie from Calvin Fry, stated that Mother thought you intended taking the golden text for lessons from Science and Health. 6 days later, Fry wrote Mackenzie again. Quote, Mother would like to know whether the Bible Lesson Committee is working up lessons from international series or from topics furnished by her. End quote. On April 26th, another letter from Calvin Fry, this time to the Bible Lesson Committee, stated, Mother has prepared the enclosed list of subjects for Sunday services to be used in the forenoon services and designs that the lessons from the international series be used for the afternoon or evening services. She requests that you at once prepare lessons from the enclosed subjects so that they may be ready to publish in the quarterly, which is now ready for the press. It is intended that the field will begin to use these lessons on the first Sunday in July, 1898. The enclosed list enumerated the 26 lesson topics essentially as they remain today. Mrs. Eddy's allusion to the prosecution of Christian Scientists in her letter to the wife of President McKinley was not unwarranted, as can be seen from this item on page 2 of the April Journal. Card. Will the brave delegates from the Churches of Christ Scientist in New York State and those faithful at their homes as well as in her Senate chamber accept my thanks for rising to the rescue of religious liberty in the land of our pilgrim fathers, and may God forever keep our country from aggressive class legislation, whether in the form of a medical bill or bull. Mary Baker G. Eddy. As on many another occasion, the leader emphasized the great danger to our country, class legislation. As the war clouds over this nation turned to war on the 25th of April, the founder seemed to be working more assiduously than ever to put her house in order, that is, the house of the Christian Science Organization. But at the same time, she was not unmindful of the national and international situation. It is altogether possible that her oneness with infinite mind made her aware of a circumstance that other Americans knew nothing of until some months later. As reported in the Christian Science Weekly the following September, not long after the opening of the war, the French government conceived a plan, the object of which was to rescue Spain to administer a rebuke to American ambition and to assert European supremacy in the complications in the Western world. By a combination of good fortune and diplomatic adroitness, the French government secured the support of the other continental powers, Germany and Russia included. The stroke was all but completely prepared, and nothing remained but to secure, if not the active adherence, at least the tacit consent or neutrality of the English government. At this point, the first and last check to the scheme was received. The English people, so reasoned the French cabinet, have suffered more from American oppression of late years than any other nation. Deeply angered by the worst part of the American press, they must have reached the limit of their endurance under the menaces of President Cleveland. Here, therefore, is their opportunity for an easy and overwhelming revenge. Accordingly, the proposition of diplomatic intervention, if that should be sufficient, or force of arms if needful, was definitely submitted to Lord Salisbury. To the unmeasured surprise and grief of the French cabinet, a reply was delivered to the effect that if the plan was not directly abandoned, not only would Her Majesty's government refuse to countenance its execution, but would join forces with the American government and declare war on France and such supporters as should come to her assistance. The negotiations at once fell through, and the French government was compelled to beat a retreat. Lord Salisbury's support of America was glorified by England's poet laureate, Alfred Austin. Sons of the Selfsame Race, 1898. What is the voice I hear on the wind of the western sea? Sentinel, listen from out Cape Clear, and say what the voice may be. 'Tis a proud free people calling loud to a people proud and free. And it says to them, kinsmen, hail! We severed have been too long. Now let us have done with a worn-out tale, the tale of an ancient wrong, and our friendship last long as love doth last, and be stronger than death is strong. Answer them, sons of the selfsame race, and blood of the selfsame clan. Let us speak with each other, face to face, and answer as man to man, and loyally love and trust each other as none but free men can. Now fling them out to the breeze, shamrock, thistle, and rose, and the star-spangled banner unfurl with these, a message to friends and foes. Wherever the sails of peace are seen, and wherever the war wind blows, a message to bond and thrall to wake, for whenever we come, we twain, the throne of the tyrant shall rock and quake, and his menace be void and vain. For you are lords of a strong young land, and we are lords of the main. Yes, this is the voice on the bluff March gale. We severed have been too long, but now we have done with a worn-out tale, the tale of an ancient wrong. And our friendship shall last as love doth last, and be stronger than death is strong. Austin's lay, no doubt, was the one that was published in the London Chronicle under the title Greeting from England. When it was brought to Mrs. Eddy's attention, she became America's first poet laureate, appointed of God, and responded, Lord of the main and manor, thy palm in ancient day didst rock the country's cradle that wakes thy laureate's lay. The full response of America's divinely appointed poet laureate was published in the Boston Herald on Sunday, May 15th. The United States to Great Britain by Mary Baker G. Eddy. Hail, brother, fling thy banner to the billows and the breeze. We proffer thee warm welcome, with our hand, though not our knees. Lord of the main and manor, thy palm in ancient day didst rock the country's cradle that wakes thy laureate's lay. The hoar fight is forgotten. Our eagle, like the dove, returns to bless a bridal betokened from above. List, brother, angels whisper to Judah's sceptered race. Thou of the selfsame spirit, allied by nation's grace, wouldst cheer the hosts of heaven, for Anglo-Israel, lo, is marching under orders, his hand averts the blow. Brave Britain, blessed America, unite your battle plan. Victorious all who live it, the love for God and man. A later issue of the Journal gave publication to an interesting aftermath, made doubly interesting and meaningful by the fact that Mrs. Eddy rarely addressed anyone as Christian Scientist. My dear Mr. Moore, you will doubtless remember that when at your house recently, there was presented to Mrs. Higman a card containing a poem to Great Britain by our revered mother. The poem was printed, I believe, by Mr. Dunbar of Boston, with the American flag on the top of the card. Had Mr. Dunbar realized fully the beautiful sentiment contained in the poem, he would, I have no doubt, have had the flags of both nations floating in unison above it. Be that as it may, I was deeply impressed by the poem, being myself an Englishman, and it occurred to me that perhaps our dear mother would permit a few of her devoted followers here, in acknowledgement of the sentiment contained in the poem, to present her with a British flag. The flag that I send you for this purpose by express today is the flag of the Dominion of Canada, that is, the British ensign, bearing the coat of arms of the Dominion. May I take the liberty of requesting your good office in making the presentation sans cérémonie to the mother? We thought first of sending a silk flag, but were advised by the manufacturer not to do so, as they are not serviceable. We are fully persuaded that to the author of Science and Health, the useful article will always be preferred before the merely ornamental. May these two flags long wave in unison as emblems of freedom and good government, and may Christian Science, the higher emblem of freedom and good government to the individual, be found flourishing, not only where the flags of our beloved nations float, but all the world over, lifting poor, tired, and soiled humanity into the haven of purity and rest. Believe me, very sincerely yours, Ormond Higman. Mr. Ormond Higman, Christian Scientist, Ottawa, Canada. My dear sir, present my tender regard and gratitude to the donor or donors of the grand ensign of your country, the Dominion of Canada. Your flag shall wave at the right hand and at the right hour, beside the stars and stripes of the American flag. The ties that a true religion and government form, God must have bound together, and no man can sunder. Give my love to Mrs. Higman, to your dear children, and to your nation. With high regard, yours, Mary Baker G. Eddy.